This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We are all still trying to come to grips with the killings in San Bernardino, California. 14 people killed, making it the sixth most deadly mass shooting in the United States since 1949. And with less than a month left in 2015, some sources, which define a mass shooting as four or more victims killed or injured, estimate that there have been more of those kinds of shootings than days in this year. But gun violence isn't just limited to mass shootings, grabbing headlines. Every day, firearm homicides and suicides vastly outpace mass murder. And taken altogether, some researchers see guns, which have claimed more lives in America than AIDS, illegal drug overdoses, wars, and terrorism combined between 2001 and 2013. These researchers see it as a threat to public health. So, if you wanted to curb shootings in this country, why not treat gun deaths as a public health issue, the same way you would treat deaths that kill tens of thousands of people struck down by disease? But one of the obstacles to treating gun deaths as a disease is that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is hamstrung from collecting data about gun deaths as it would collect data about disease deaths. Well, why? Joining me to discuss the question is Sandro Galea. She's the dean of a Boston University School of Public Health, and he joins us today from Zambia by phone. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Joining me is Garen Wintemute. He's a professor of emergency medicine and director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at the UC Davis School of Medicine in Sacramento, California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Garen, why has the CDC's hands been tied when it comes to funding research that looks at the effects of gun violence?
To put it very simply, they don't have any money. 20 years ago, Congress took from CDC the funds that they were spending for research on firearm violence and gave them that money allocated for another purpose, and wrote some language into CDC's budget that has been interpreted as a ban on CDC conducting or funding research. As a point of fact, there simply is no money for research from CDC. It's not that they're banned from doing it.
Is there any effort to try to get that money back in there to study it that way?
Yes. The Obama administration, since 2013, has been pushing for such funding to be available. Congress has refused to provide it. An interesting side story, the Congressman Jay Dickey, who led the successful effort to strip CDC of its research funding back in the mid-1990s, has since recanted and recently, including today, has been in public saying that that was a mistake and that CDC should be allowed to conduct and fund research. Other federal agencies do. The National Institutes of Health, for the first time in its history, is funding research specifically on firearm violence. The National Institute of Justice has been doing it pretty much all along.
Hmm. Sandra, if we're talking about a disease that kills tens of thousands of people each year in the U.S., do you think the CDC would investigate it if it could?
Well, I think the CDC would and should, and I suspect that many in the CDC want to. I think Dr. Wintemute is entirely correct. There is 20 years of effort to actively discourage, if not legally prohibit, CDC from studying gun violence. And in the past couple of years, the Obama administration has reversed that, but at the same time, there has also been no extra money given to CDC to do this. So you have a disease which we understand there's a pathogen for, but we have very little data on because our premier public health organization has been hamstrung for decades. So we know far less about what we can do to curb gun violence than we would if we had the same number of 32,000 people dying a year from an infectious agent, for example.
Is there any centralized database of people who have been affected by gun violence?
There is no registry of people who've been affected by gun violence. There are individual research efforts. We have done some. Dr. Wintermute has done even more. But there is no registry of victims of gun violence in the same way as there is, for example, a registry of survivors of 9/11 or registries of survivors of any number of large-scale events that have taken a lot of life in this country.
Dr. Wintermute, do we know how people react after being affected by gun violence? Is it... You know, seeing it, being part of a family, or being injured themselves?
Some research has been done, including on mass shootings. And perhaps not surprisingly, we learned that long-term emotional scars, if you will, or psychological scars are common. They're more common with increasing intensity of exposure to the violence. Relatively little work has been done on this because, as we've just discussed, there's been no support for it. But to the extent that we do know, the evidence suggests that firearm violence is different even from other forms of violence. So, for example, the Bureau of Justice Statistics last year published a major report on the long-term social and psychological sequelae of violence. And if that violence involved a firearm, the odds that there would be such long-term effects more than doubled. That was an effect that was far greater than if some other weapon were involved. There is something unique about firearm violence.
Let me just add to that for a second, Ira. We tend to forget in our public discussions that there are about 32,000 people who die from firearms a year, but there are about 180,000 who are injured. So although there's no direct evidence about this, but we can extrapolate from other data like the one Dr. Wintermute just mentioned, and we can guess that about 30% of people who are injured by being shot will go on to have long-term emotional sequelae. So that's another 60,000 people a year who go on to have long-term mental illness, psychological distress. And that, of course, is not counting their family members or the family members of the loved ones who died unexpectedly, which is in and of itself a traumatic event.
Go ahead. I'll let you finish. It's important.
Yeah, so if you were to really tally the consequences, we all talk, and the media has been very good at in the past few weeks at pointing out 32,000 people dying a year. Now you have 180,000 people who are actually injured. From those, let's say 60, 70,000 go on to have post-traumatic stress disorder or depression. Then you have the family members of the those who died, and probably 10 to 20% of them will also go on to have long-term emotional sequelae. So very, very quickly, you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who are affected by this epidemic, and there is no other way of characterizing this than it is an epidemic and it is a preventable epidemic.
And that number is repeated every year.
That number is every year. So in terms of the long-term psychological sequelae, let's say post-traumatic stress disorder, we know that once you have chronic post-traumatic stress, it lasts for years and years. So if you take my conservative estimate of 60,000 people, then that is you're building on that year after year.
And we have no apparatus for following these people because being involved in a shooting is not considered to be a disease like you would following people who had the measles and following them up.
It is not reportable anyway, no.
Yeah. Now, go ahead. Please jump in.
If I could generalize, we have no apparatus for following these people for the same reasons that we have very little research on firearm violence generally. And an instructive contrast is to motor vehicle injuries, where faced with an epidemic 50 years ago, we did what America does best. We mobilized. We put smart people on the case. We gave them funding to do research. Policymakers were interested in translating the results of that research into policy, with the end result today being that their motor vehicle-related death rate is more than 50% lower than it was back then. We would be dealing with maybe 150,000 motor vehicle-related deaths a year rather than the much smaller number we have today. We have repeatedly, consciously, and deliberately turned our back on this epidemic. The result being that these days there's a neck-and-neck race between firearms and motor vehicles to see which will kill more people each year. You are absolutely right that we hear these same numbers year after year. Firearm mortality rates have not budged since the year 2000. It's because we're not doing anything about the problem.
Let me add to what Dr. Wintem you just said. What is remarkable about the motor vehicle example is that while the number of motor vehicle deaths has gone down about fivefold, the number of vehicle miles driven in this country has gone up about fivefold. So essentially, we have succeeded over the past 50 years in lowering what you might expect as a motor vehicle fatality by about a 25-fold factor. And that is, as Dr. Wintem correctly said, a testament to the fact that we set our minds to it, that we started collecting data, and we started implementing policies to try to see what works and doing so nationally. The fact is, on the issue of firearms, we are not trying. We are not really doing very much at all. We have a patchwork of laws in different states, and some of that is being evaluated. Of course, we know that state borders are porous and that guns cross state lines. So we have neither data nor a concerted national effort to deal with it, which would work. We know it works because motor vehicles are but one of many examples where we have shown we can do it and we can save lives if we set our mind to it.
I've got about a minute to go. Is there any possibility that something will happen?
Something? Yes. Yes.
Quickly.
I think the tide is shifting. People understand, primarily because of mass shootings, which are affecting our entire society, not just the people who were shot or witnessed, realizing we all have a stake in this. We all need to make a commitment. At a minimum, I think that will shake loose funding for more research.
All right. We'll follow this. We've run out of time. Sandro Galea is a dean of Boston University School of Public Health. Garen Wittemute is a professor of emergency medicine, director of the Violence Prevention Research Program, UC Davis School of Medicine. Stay with us. We're going to talk about Kurt Vonnegut's connection to cloud seeding. It's all in the family after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The year was 1947. Business was booming for the General Electric Company. Sales of light bulbs, turbines, and motors were up. World War II was over, and washing machines were in. But in its 1947 annual report, GE saved the really exciting news for last. With a trumpet fanfare, they announced that GE scientists were finally doing something about the weather. Researchers had manufactured real snow and rain using a brand new technique, cloud seeding.
For the first time in all history, there is now open to man the possibility of exerting some control over the weather. Probably the most remarkable achievement of the year.
GE scientists were making rain, the company said, and the scientist who perfected the technique was a young pompadoured chemist named Bernard Vonnegut. Bernie's little brother Kurt worked at GE too. He was a PR man, a struggling writer who barely survived the firebombing in Dresden, and he was both fascinated and horrified by GE's headlong rush into the future. My next guest says Bernard's discoveries and GE stuck with Kurt Vonnegut his entire writing life. Ginger Strand is the author of a new joint biography of Kurt and Bernard Vonnegut. It's called The Brothers Vonnegut, Science and Fiction in the House of Magic. She joins us to talk about it. Ginger, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
A great book. You know, and as I was reading it, I was amazed that no one has told this story before.
I felt that way the whole time I was writing it, actually, which was, there was one point where I said to a friend, I really can't wait to finish this writing this book because I really want to know how it ends.
So tell us how they both got involved with General Electric.
Well, Bernard Vonnegut, who was 8 years older than Kurt, went to work for GE right after the war. He had been in the conscripted by the Chemical Warfare Service during the war itself, and he was doing research into de-icing of aircraft, which was a very compelling little fact to me. He was actually helping those bomber planes get in and out of their bombing missions. In the process of doing that, he met up with a couple of GE scientists, began to share information with them, and as a result was invited to apply to GE immediately at the end of the war, which he did.
And so while he was at GE and while Bernard was working at GE, it was nicknamed the House of Magic.
Well, the research lab, the GE research lab, was nicknamed the House of Magic. The scientists actually didn't like that name.
They said,
we're not doing magic. We're doing science. You know, it's all real. But it was a great handle for the PR guys. So they kept using it.
So it was a lot like Bell Labs in those days. You come in, you just sky, do whatever you'd like and discover
things. Very much. The scientists were allowed to do pure research in addition to, you know, helping make GE's light bulbs ever better.
Mm-hmm. So here is Kurt, and he's working at GE, but he's not working on the science part, is he?
No, he was recommended by his older brother for a job there because he had some newsroom experience. He'd worked on his college paper, his high school paper, and he'd, in fact, worked in the city newsroom in Chicago for a little while. But he also had a science background. He had been a biochemistry student at Cornell before he dropped out to join the military. So he was able to go in and kind of speak to the things that GE was doing at the time. And he was also a very good writer.
So he's writing all these great press releases about the great stuff that's going on.
Exactly. Press releases rolling off his typewriter about GE's latest new invention, you know.
And let's talk about one of the great discoveries that you mentioned in the book, and that is this cloud seeding experiment, where GE scientists discover that cloud seeding is really a low-tech. Doesn't take much to do it. They discovered cloud seeding, and they did it in a home freezer, one of GE's own freezers?
Yes. You know, they had Irving Langmuir, the Nobel laureate, and Vincent Schaefer, who worked with Bernard Vonnegut, hypothesized that clouds often hold a lot of supercooled water, water that is below the freezing point but has not condensed yet and become heavy enough to fall as rain. So they thought, well, let's see what we can do. Let's see if we can try to make it rain. So they brought in a GE freezer, you know, just a box freezer like you would have in your garage, and they lined it with black velvet and shone a light on it so that they could see it. And then they just breathed into it and formed a little cloud, and then they just began spraying it with things to see if anything would produce a little miniature snowstorm right there in the freezer.
And it worked.
Well, there was one day where the freezer, it was so hot in the lab that Vincent's freezer couldn't keep up, so he just threw in a block of dry ice, and presto, there was a miniature snowstorm. So that was the first discovery was that dry ice would nucleate, as they say, clouds. Bernard subsequently discovered that the chemical silver iodide would do the same thing.
Oh, such serendipity, always working all the time.
Yeah.
Now, GE, which loved to make movies of these things,
mm-hmm.
They made a film of scientist Vincent Schaefer doing this icebox experiment, and here he is making artificial snow.
Using a home freezing unit such as this, we can form supercool clouds just like those in the natural atmosphere by breathing into the box. This cloud is made up of liquid water droplets. They are not snow crystals as yet, but by taking a tiny piece of dry ice such as this and scratching it so a few tiny fragments fall into the supercool cloud, long streaks develop just like the vapor trail from an airplane. These contain millions and millions of tiny submicroscopic snow crystals, which grow very fast and assume exactly the same forms that natural snowflakes show in an ordinary snowstorm.
Now, did you have to learn why this worked?
Yeah, to some extent, yes. I spent a lot of time, harassing, perhaps.
Haranguing?
Cloud physicists. They harangued me. I followed some people around who were doing some cloud seeding in the Sierra Nevada, and that was really interesting.
And so why does it work? What's going on there?
It's actually pretty straightforward with the silver iodide. I mean, a water droplet, in order to become heavy enough to fall, typically needs something to adhere to. Sometimes they will cling to each other, but if there's not enough of that going on in the cloud, they might just hang out there in the sky. If you nucleate them, if you give them a nucleus to cling to, they will fall out as precipitation.
Hmm.
And that's how the silver iodide works.
Now, I understand, being the curious person that you are and the great writer, you actually did the same experiment in a home, in your home freezer?
Well,
can we do this at home?
You can. It was irresistible, actually, because while I was working on this project, I think it was, you know, it was around the holidays, and someone sent me one of those boxes of Omaha steaks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they come with some dry ice, and I got very excited, and, you know, other people in my household were laughing at me, but I was determined to try this, so I kind of emptied out the freezer and breathed into it and made a cloud and threw the dry ice in, and sure enough, there was like a tiny miniature snowstorm right there.
Now, of course, once word gets out about something like this from General Electric, you know the military is going to show some interest in it, right?
Particularly in that period when every new scientific advance is being investigated for its potential as a new super weapon.
And so they thought, hey, if we can make it rain or cause storms someplace, we've got a weapon that we can use.
Yeah, they were thinking that way, and the GE scientists were not. The GE scientists were thinking, hey, we can bring rain to the desert maybe, or prevent hailstorms from damaging crops. The military was thinking, you know, if we can steer a hurricane, we can really mess with Cuba.
Right. I remember seeing cloud seeding experiments in the early 70s in Florida.
Mm.
And I was actually watching them do this. It's a long story short, and they were telling me that they were more worried that they couldn't control the rain if it happened. And they were worried about, we'll have to stop these things if we don't know how to stop the rain.
Yeah, well, there was a similar incident in New York City in 1950 where the city was running out of water after a couple years of drought and decided to cloud seed the Catskills in order to produce rain. And after a very soggy summer and a disastrous flood in the fall, they were promptly slapped with many, many lawsuits.
Yeah, that'll stop it really fast. Let's get back to Kurt now. So now we're seeing all these wonderful things going on in a refrigerator in GE, and Kurt is seeing all these things, right? And he wants to write stuff about it?
Yeah. So Kurt and his brother were quite close. They lived next door to each other. They socialized together. Kurt met all of his brother's friends. He asked Bernard to explain things to him when he didn't understand them. And Bernard is growing at this time more and more concerned about the work that he's doing. Not only is the military kind of eager to turn it into a weapon, but he's also concerned that people might use it carelessly, that, you know, it really should be controlled and kept track of. So Kurt's watching Bernard go through this, and he had been writing stories, unsuccessful stories, one after the other. And he started to write a new kind of story, which featured scientific advances and scientists grappling with the moral implications of them.
And so GE stuff that he's seeing starts showing up sort of disguised.
Absolutely.
In his story.
Thinly disguised, really, if you look at it. I mean, that was a very surprising thing to me mucking around in the GE archive. I just kept turning over story after story that was obviously the precedent for an early Kurt Vonnegut work of fiction.
Mm-hmm. In case you just joined us, we're talking with Ginger Strand, author of this new joint biography of Kurt and Bernard Vonnegut, the brothers Vonnegut, Science and Fiction in the House of Magic. It's really a magical book. Let's talk about Kurt's report on the Barnhouse effect, which is directly resultant from the work he's looking at.
Very much so. You know, Professor Barnhouse discovers that he can control something that people thought couldn't be controlled. In his case, it's not weather, it's telekinesis. He's got some, you know, ability to move things around. Immediately, the military gets involved. They want to make it into a new super weapon. Professor Barnhouse is dubious about it. They take over his project. They give it a sci-fi code name, Project Wishing Well. Bernard's project had a sci-fi code name. It was called Project Cirrus. And they start trying to weaponize it, and Professor Barnhouse has to figure out how to stop them.
Oh, yeah, there it is. And Kurt's breakout novel, Cat's Cradle, where do you see the Bernard Vonnegut and GE in that book?
It's all over that book. It really is. Kurt often spoke in later years about how he had based the character of Felix Honecker on Irving Langmuir, Bernard's superior colleague. But the description of Ice 9, which of course is a form of ice that's stable, a solid at room temperature, is very much, you know, uses the same exact wording that Bernard used to describe his own invention to Kurt.
How did GE react to this? Did they get alarmed? They start seeing these things showing up as fiction? Or,
you know, not at first, I don't think. There was one telltale detail that I was able to uncover, which is that not a single bookstore in Schenectady would stock Player Piano, Kurt's first novel, when it came out, which was also very much a portrait of GE at the time that he was there.
Yeah, but everybody else was buying it up like hotcakes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Bernard told Kurt that there was a sort of underground traffic in Player Piano coming up from New York City to Schenectady.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with Ginger Strand, author of The Brothers Vonnegut, The Science and Fiction in the House of Magic. You know, as a New Yorker, I used to see Kurt all over the city here in bookstores and whatever.
Yeah,
He loved New York.
Yeah, I never met him. I was that's sad.
You could never mistake Kurt Vonnegut in a store, and he used to wear a trench coat and walk around. It was great to see that. Bernie and Gene really never figured out how to prove that cloud seeding worked, did they? Have we come any closer? I mean, the seeding experiments are still going on, aren't they?
They are. And in fact, a recent study has established, it was conducted by the state of Wyoming, and has established that with the right kind of cloud in the right kind of environment, you can expect the right kind of cloud seeding to increase the yield of your winter storms by 5 to 15%.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, it's been debated and argued for many, many years.
Yeah. We talked earlier about the Paris Climate Conference.
Mm-hmm.
You see any connection between Bernard's story and what's happening with the climate change?
Very much so. I mean, what the GE scientists were doing and the meteorological community generally at this time, and there was cloud seeding was a very controversial issue among the meteorologists. But they were laying the groundwork for climate science. They were trying to figure out, you know, is it possible that human beings can have an effect on the climate? And many people said, of course, it's not possible. And others said, no, we really should think about this.
Mm-hmm. And how did Kurt feel? Did he start getting a reputation as a science fiction writer? Did he like that? Or
that was very problematic for him. In some ways, he liked it. But in other ways, you know, he once asked why he chose to write science fiction early in his career. He said there was no avoiding it because General Electric was science fiction. He really felt he was writing social satire that was very clearly and directly based on what he saw going on in the world today.
Mm-hmm. So what piqued your interest now that you've written this book? Any follow-up ideas? I mean, you've gone into find these connections you never thought existed.
I think that's something that I generally do, is put odd things together. And the next book will surely be odd.
Okay. We're not going to hear about that. Let's go to John in Sacramento. Hi, John.
Hello. My question is, it's not clear to me from this stage, is where is this now? For example, it didn't break the drought in California last year. But I know people in the Sierra Nevada that feel like they're not getting rain because it's being stolen from them by cloud seeding. So I'm curious as to what's happening now.
Conspiracy theory, someplace.
Well, it's an important question that to be asked of cloud seeding. Does it steal water from the downstream communities? And in general, the cloud seeders will tell you no. What cloud seeding does is it makes the clouds more efficient. If you think of a cloud not as a reservoir of water, but as a factory for making water, it makes more sense. The cloud actually produces more rain. It's more efficient when you cloud seed it. The problem is, of course, that you can't cloud seed a sky that doesn't already have clouds full of water in it. It only works where you have enough water in the pipeline, as it were, you know, coming into the environment. So you can't really, you know, cloud seed.
You can't create the cloud.
You can't make the cloud.
The cloud has to be there, and you hope that you can get it to rain.
You don't make a cloud. You just build a better cloud.
I can't think of a better way to end this conversation than building a better cloud, which is what they tried to do over there in GE. It's all in a great book. I mean, it's a nice book. The Brothers Vonnegut, Science and Fiction in the House of Magic. Ginger Strand is the author. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck with the book.
Thanks.
And happy holiday. You can read an excerpt from it, and it's really good. You can see a video of GE scientists making that snow that we talked about. You can see that video at sciencefriday.com/Vonnegut. Excerpt from the book, this cool video. It's an old one. It's nice to look at. sciencefriday.com/Vonnegut. We're going to take a break. We'll come back right after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You know, there are a lot of kitchen experiments you as an amateur scientist can do at home, for example. You ever shaken a jar of heavy whipping cream till it separates into butter? It's pretty easy. We even do it in kindergarten, right? But it's also kind of mind-blowing, the realization that, hey, you can actually make this stuff, real butter. It's not just something that comes pre-wrapped in the refrigerator aisle. And it tastes a lot better, too. So you walk around the supermarket these days, and you'll see there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff. They're products people used to make themselves, but they don't do that anymore. Here's looking at you, sour cream. My next guest is a ninja of those lost culinary arts, and he's here with a few tricks to get more out of your cooking by doing it yourself. Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Cooks, and Good Food. He's out with a new edition with new experiments you're going to want to try. And you can find a few at sciencefriday.com/cookingforgeeks. Jeff, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. If you got any kitchen hacks of your own or needed a little science to improve your made-from-scratch recipes, you can give us a call, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Jeff, there's a lot of stuff in your kitchen these days. There's one or two steps removed from the natural state. It's almost there, right? Minimally processed. I'm thinking like vanilla extract. But we've got sort of forgotten how to make all this stuff. When did we lose that ability to make all this stuff?
You know, I think a lot of that happened post-World War II, when we kind of got to two people in the family, both in the workplace, and convenience of buying things from home. And there was that space age excitement of the modern, you know,
yeah,
go to the store and buy something. And, you know, it's actually kind of amazing how much science contributed to the ability for us to make food. But here we are, you know, 50 years kind of after that point, and we've kind of forgotten some things. So one of the great things I've had fun this last year doing is digging into, well, what happens? How can we do these things ourselves?
How can we make, and well, vanilla is...
Well, vanilla is easy.
Is easy. Yeah. How do you make the extract?
Vanilla, you can just literally take vanilla bean, slice it open and drop it into a small jar with a little bit of vodka. Vodka being ethanol is a great solvent, and this is how you make vanilla extract.
People would love to try that.
it's easy, I tell you, especially if you're cooking with the vanilla bean.
Right.
You know, don't throw it away. Drop it in a little small container with some vodka and, you know, put it in the fridge or keep it up for a week or two, and then you'll have vanilla extract.
Yeah, you know, that's great. There's one condiment that people don't use too often, but a really fun project to make, and that is liquid smoke.
Liquid smoke is fascinating. This is one of those ones that demonstrates some really great chemistry. It's made fundamentally by taking whatever your smoke source is, hickory chips, say, putting them, yeah, inside a container that you then heat, and you take the smoke from that container, a closed container. So we're not talking about combustion. There's no oxygen here. You heat it up, and that smoke you then direct through water, and that water will actually dissolve some of the smoke compounds into it, and it's that water ends up being what we call liquid smoke, and it's got all the flavor compounds. And
wow,
that begins to give you a little insight that sometimes these things that come in a bottle are actually very simple. Sometimes they're not, though.
Is it safer than actually grilling, get the smoke?
You know, there is some thinking that, in fact, liquid smoke should be safer because a lot of the carcinogenic compounds end up either precipitating out or floating out and not being in suspension inside that liquid.
All right, I can't hold back myself anymore because I'm looking at some wonderful pieces of chocolate and other things that you've brought in.
Chocolate was another one of those fun ones to look into. And who could resist chocolate?
Not me,
so,
that's for sure.
In this case, chocolate, you know, as we think about it, that nice bar of chocolate that, you know, mm-hmm, you see Charlie and the Chocolate Factory opening up, goes through a process called conching. And that process was invented in the 1870s by a guy whose last name was Lindt. Quite familiar to those of us who like chocolate these days. And that process really takes the cocoa fat, the cocoa butter, and sugar and really grinds them together in a way. But before Lindt came up with that process, chocolate was unconched. It had this texture that wasn't smooth. It wasn't really for eating. So you can kind of approximate this at home if you grab some cocoa fat, which is the same thing as cocoa butter, about 30-35% by weight, some cocoa powder, also 30-35% by weight, and the rest sugar. Melt the cocoa butter, throw in the cocoa solids, the cocoa powder that is, and the sugar, and mix it up, and you'll get something that looks a bit like that piece that you are looking
this
at.
This round
and
one?
That round one. So, so take a bite of it. Now, keep in mind that before we had conching, chocolate was not really a great thing for eating. It was gritty. It didn't have that fine texture. I mean, the flavor is interesting, and it's a fun thing to try.
It's good.
Yeah.
You know, it's because it's not too sweet. Yeah.
Well, in this case, it's because there's not too much sugar in there.
Not too much sugar. And, it's delicious. Let me tell you.
I always know it bringing food into the studio is a great thing.
now, when you see the cocoa content or the you go out and you want to get these bars, let's say 75-80%. What are they talking about?
They're talking about the percent of cocoa product in there, which is a combination of the cocoa fat and the cocoa powder. They're not telling you what the ratio of those two different ingredients. So the other thing that I brought in for you, you see some little white pellets there. Those white pellets are just cocoa fat. I'm going to warn you, they're not particularly delicious. They're not white chocolate. It's just the fat. How would you how would you describe that?
No flavor.
No flavor.
But I can feel the texture of chocolate.
Yeah, it's got the texture.
It's got that mouthfeel.
And the fats in chocolate are actually really fascinating. There's a whole thing about polymorphism, the way they crystallize, the ratios of triglycerides in there. And it's actually somewhat similar to butter, but not quite. So that 70% or 75%, when you see that in the bar, if you've got two different bars that both say 70% from different manufacturers, one might be higher cocoa powder, cocoa solid content. Huh. And then we might have less.
Is there any way to know that when you look at things?
You might be able to be clever by backing out the fat concentration. I haven't actually checked that one. I don't think you can really do it realistically, though, at home. Maybe if you had some lab equipment.
And what happens when the chocolate hangs around a long time and it gets a little, like a white film on it?
White film. So that's called blooming. And there's actually two different kinds of blooming that can happen with chocolate. There's either fat blooming or sugar blooming. Most of the time when you see white stuff, it's fat blooming. That's the migration of those cocoa butter, cocoa fat, through the actual solid matter. I mean, if you look at a bar of chocolate, it's actually a really complicated physical structure. Mm-hmm. You've got cocoa solids, which are particulate, suspended inside fat, which, you know, most of us think of that bar as being solid, but the fats in there are a mixture of different triglycerides, and some of those fats are actually liquid at room temperature. Not so much that you notice it, but they do migrate.
But so it's not unsafe to eat that.
It's not unsafe to eat. It's just it's going to have a texture that won't be as enjoyable because it impacts the texture. Melt it down or use it in something to cook with. Mm-hmm.
As you know, we love to talk about microbes and fermentation on this show.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about sour cream. Is that fermented? Sour cream is fermented.
Sour cream, that's what makes it sour. It's bacteria. If you know how to make yogurt, you know how to make sour cream. Just use cream instead of milk. Mind blown. It's one of those things where it's like...
My mind is just... It's a mushroom cloud here. can you turn regular cream into sour cream?
Yes. You take a regular container of sour cream. The easiest place to get the starter bacteria is from yogurt. So just get some live active cultured yogurt, throw a teaspoon into the container, stir it up, and basically let it, quote unquote, go bad. You can let it sit on the counter overnight. If you happen to have a yogurt maker or a slow cooker that's got a yogurt mode, that's better. And that the culture from that yogurt will chow down on the lactose and other stuff that's present in the cream. There shouldn't be too much lactose in cream, but it'll chow down on the stuff in the cream to actually make it into sour cream.
Will it get that gloppy consistency?
It won't get quite as thick as maybe some of the sour cream you're used to, because a lot of commercial stuff sometimes includes thickeners, cornstarch or carrageenan or guar gum. But you'll look and go, oh, this is sour cream.
Yeah. Our number, 844-724-8255, if you have questions about food science, which we're talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Cooks, Good Food, out with a new edition with new experiments. What new things did you put in the book?
Oh, wow.
Were there things that people asked you for? Or?
Well, there's a lot of different things. There's the second edition's got over 150 pages of brand new material.
Wow.
So there's a bunch of new interviews with folks like Jacques Pepin, Deborah Madison, Bridget Lancaster, a number of chefs who it was really a pleasure to speak with. There's a whole section, actually, we're talking about fats here. There's a whole section I added in about fats. You know, what are trans fats? How's that compared to what's called a cis fat? You know, what's the breakdown of different fat sources? There's new experiments. So if you've got a middle-aged kid and you want to do a few things in the kitchen, you can do everything from calibrate your oven to calibrating your freezer, just using the physical properties of things like sugar or salt water. It was so much fun to go back and dig into it.
I'll bet. This is a really interesting section in your book. It's not a do-it-yourself opportunity unless you happen to have a mass spectrometer lying around. But you have a section in the book that talks about how Sherlock Holmes would determine where a tomato was grown.
This one was really fun. You know, we think of water as just being H2O. And right. Maybe if you've got a glass of water, okay, there's some air dissolved in there and maybe some solids, you know, some minerals. But even if you just look at the H2O, there are differences between different molecules. And these are called isotopomers. So if you think about oxygen, you know, it's oxygen 16, as in 8 neutrons and 8 protons. But you can actually have additional neutrons in there. So you can have oxygen 17, oxygen 18, and that'll change. Those isotopes will change the actual molecule of water. And those changes change the weight of the water. And that rate, that change in the weight changes the rate of evaporation. So the water that has the heavier isotopes will end up not evaporating as quickly. So if you're in a climate, in an environment where you have a high amount of evaporation, your soil water will skew towards the heavier isotopes. So you can take that tomato and take a sample of the liquid from it and run it through a mass spectrometer and go, okay, wait a second, this is coming from, you know, something that's got this ratio of these isotopomers. And if you look into a bunch of different, you know, factor in about a dozen different trace elements, you can pinpoint pretty accurately where something comes from.
Wow, so you can rule out the tomato came from this part of the world versus it's a warmer climate.
And if you factor in a few of the other things like magnesium or various trace elements, you can begin to get country of origin. It's a huge thing for actually food fraud and food traceability. If you've got honey that's being imported, how do you know where it's coming from?
Well, let's go to the phones to Savannah, Georgia, one of my favorite cities. To Greg, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
Well, I just want to tell you about some things that I've been doing. I started on a fermentation craze. My wife likes to say I didn't buy a sports car. I started fermenting things. And one of the things I've been doing is I used to brew beer years ago, and I started doing it again. And I decided these spent grains ought to be useful for something. So I ground them up, pulverized them, and decided I would substitute a cup of the spent grains in a sourdough bread instead of a cup of the flour. And it's worked out really well.
Wow. Let me get a comment. Let me remind everybody first that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you joined us, we're talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Cooks, Good Food. So he's now made double use of his.
That's fantastic and clever, and actually sounds delicious. There's a lot of things with our cooking where we have something that's left over that we then kind of just throw away. We were talking just a few minutes ago about the vanilla extract idea. You've got a vanilla being left over from making a vanilla custard for the holidays or something. You know, the idea of reusing something is fantastic. You know, apple peels. If you're peeling apples, those peels can be used in a salad, for example. There's lots of cases where you can be clever if you think about the ratio of, like, what is this thing? Is this carbohydrate? Is this protein? Is this, sugar? Like, what is the actual thing you're working with? In the case of the grains that are left over from making the beer, there'll be a fair amount of starches and cellulose and stuff in there that you can use as part of your bread. It'll be a toothier, denser bread, but it'll still taste delicious.
You answered in your book a question I've been wondering about for years, having being a watery person, loving the ocean, having gone around the world seeing salt evaporation ponds. And I would say to myself, hey, I could do this at home. I could just get a cup of water from the ocean and make my own sea salt. But you go, uh-oh, watch out.
You can definitely do it yourself with the sea salt, but you're also going to do it yourself with the mercury. potentially, because unlike that liquid smoke example where you're actually separating out something, with the do-it-yourself sea salt, you're concentrating everything. There's not a separation process there. It's just a concentration. So anything else that happens to be in the water that doesn't evaporate away is going to be there. So I don't know if I'd want to do-it-yourself sea salt.
No, you talked me out of that one. And you, but you can roll your own oats, it says in the book, right?
This one was fun, too. You know, we think about those Quaker oats you might see that are rolled out and flat.
Right.
And you might also have a container of steel-cut oats and not realize that these two things are very closely related. If you get that steel-cut oat wet enough and you flatten it
out,
you can take the back of a spoon and just press one, and it's going to look like that.
Because my wife loves the steel-cut oats, and I like the flat oats, so I can now make one out of the other.
You can try to do it. It's a little bit messy. The starches end up sticking that pressed oat to whatever you rolled out on pretty good. The commercial manufacturing process, a little easier. I think probably in your case, just buy two containers.
A little time-consuming.
But still really cool to see where your food comes from, to understand that process and kind of pull back the curtain one layer and go, how is my food being made? How can I make it? How can I dig into the science behind this a bit more?
Anything for the holiday season that you might suggest for us? Some cooking trick? Or I know you always say, and maybe we'll bring this up again, you always say the best thing that you can buy, the number one thing that you can buy in the holidays is what?
Besides a copy of my book.
Besides a copy of, but you're talking about the thermometer.
Get a probe thermometer. The number one thing I can tell anybody is get a probe thermometer, because when it comes to something like a holiday roast or something cooking in the oven, it's not about the time. It's about the temperature. So if you take a piece of fish, when I cook salmon, I cook it to 130 degrees Fahrenheit. And I stick a probe thermometer with a long lead, and I set the little unit to go beep, 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 beep when it hits 130. So instead of a timer telling me time to check it, it just tells me when it's done.
There you go. Thank you, Jeff. Good luck with the book. It's great, as always. Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Cooks, Good Food. Now in its second edition with a lot of new tips and tricks. Give it a look. He's also a software engineer in his spare time in New York. I don't know when you get that done. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy holidays.
And you too. And did you know that today is National Cookie Day? Just in time for the holidays, we had Jeff on the show last year to talk about his patent-violating cookie recipe. And for the perfect chocolate chip cookie, gooey in the center, crisp on the outside, how do you do it? Well, the secret is up there in our website, sciencefriday.com/chocolate chip cookie. sciencefriday.com/chocolate chip cookie. And it was great. I tried it last year. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you'd like to send us email, our address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. Or you could go to our website at Science Friday and talk to us there. And we're up there all week long, all month long on Facebook and Twitter. You can tweet us at SciFry. We're happy to hear from you. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.